Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Frances Bassett, and I am the attorney for the appellant, the Ute Indian Tribe of the Uinta and Ouray Reservation. I'd like to begin by thanking the court for taking the time to hear oral argument today in this case. The sole issue on appeal is whether the tribe has sovereign immunity against the claims alleged against it under the third-party complaint that was filed by the appellee, Thimmel Natural Resources, LLC. The court has before it two documents that contain waivers of the tribe's sovereign immunity. The first document is called an oil and gas exploration and development agreement. We call it an EDA for short. The second document is the operating agreement for UFNR LLC. And the tribe is, in my argument, I will be explaining why neither one of these immunity waivers applied to the claims alleged under the third-party complaint. I believe in this case, especially reviewing it for oral argument, I think there's three separate legal grounds on which the district court can be reversed, and I'll discuss each one of those in turn. The first thing I'll discuss is what I took to calling, in preparing this argument, the mother of all red herrings, or stated differently, why this court shouldn't get trapped in the futile exercise of chasing its tail in a circle, trying to decide whether or not the immunity waiver or waivers under the EDA apply. Next, I will discuss FNR's failure to satisfy the condition precedent that is contained in the immunity waiver in the second document, the operating agreement. Finally, I'll discuss why, even if the condition precedent is overlooked, the immunity waiver in the operating agreement does not apply to FNR's claims under the third-party complaint. First, why the waiver under the EDA does not apply. Why the court shouldn't waste time chasing its tail in a circle, evaluating the waiver clause or clauses as Fennell sees it under the EDA. The district court did not address the waiver clause or clauses under the EDA, and there's a good reason for that. Because that clause or clauses have no application to Fennell's third-party claims. Our lawsuit did not represent the tribe in the district court. And so we took over the case at a point in time where the legal issues had already been framed and ruled upon. We did feel it necessary to address in our briefing to this court the waiver or waivers under the EDA. And for two reasons. First, because the question of immunity is reviewed de novo. And secondly, because the parties had briefed the potential application of the EDA waiver or waivers to the district court. But there's a simple reason why the waiver or waivers under the EDA have no application. And that's because the Ute Tribe is not a commercial participant under the EDA. The Ute Tribe, as the Ute Tribe, has never been a commercial participant under the EDA. And so, in preparing for oral argument, I sort of have this epiphany. I realized that this is as much a question of parties, correct parties under Rule 17, as it is a question of tribal sovereign immunity. Count one of Fennell's third party complaint could and probably should be dismissed on the ground that the Ute Tribe is not even a real party or a proper party in interest, at least under count one. And this is because count one of Fennell's third party complaint seeks to have a court determine who are the commercial participants under the EDA. And as I said, the Ute Tribe has never been a commercial participant under the EDA in its capacity as the Ute Tribe. The tribe has been a commercial participant under the EDA only through its interest in separate legal entities. First, through an entity called Northern Ute Partnership. Secondly, through an entity called Ute FNR LLC. and now through an entity called Ute Energy LLC. These are legal entities who are or would be proper parties under Count 1, but not the Ute Tribe.
So you're saying, Counsel, that if the district court were to conclude that Ute Energy has forfeited its rights under the EDA, that the tribe has no axe to grind here?
The court is not being asked. I think, you know, we explain in our brief that under the CDA, and, you know, in looking at that EDA, I think it's a poorly drafted instrument. I think we put in one instrument what should have been put in two. Because in the EDA, the Ute Tribe is a party to the EDA in two different capacities. And the EDA is pretty clear about distinguishing between those. The court, under the current complaint, has not been asked to declare the rights of the Ute Tribe as landowner, lessor, or sovereign.
That much is undisputed.
Yes. So that, to the extent that your question said, would the Ute Tribe be happy? I'm not sure, again, how you phrased it exactly, but the Ute Tribe, as a tribe, has no commercial interest.
On the lessee side?
Yes.
Okay.
The EDA states expressly that whatever commercial interest the tribe has under the EDA, and I'm quoting now from the EDA, any commercial interest the tribe has under the EDA will be held, quote, in a single or multi-member limited liability company, partnership, corporation, or similar entity which has no attributes of sovereign immunity. That's section 8.4 of the EDA. It's on page 34 of the EDA. So, and at the present time, other than FIML itself, the only other commercial participant under the EDA is Ute Energy LLC. Ute Energy LLC is the plaintiff in this lawsuit, and Ute Energy is not asserting sovereign immunity against FIML's counterclaims. The Ute Tribe is a member of Ute Energy LLC, and you know, the counterclaims against Ute Energy include the same request for a declaration of who has the commercial interest under the EDA.
Sure. If I had understood your colleague's claims here, it is essentially kind of a derivative argument. It seems to me that they're trying to say that Ute Energy has forfeited its right to further development under the EDA, and therefore, and in other aspects of the declaratory judgment actions, they're essentially trying to articulate that Ute Energy really isn't a viable entity at all. And so that whatever interest the tribe has on the lessee side of this would have to be sort of on the tribe itself. That's my sense of it. So, you know, if they turn out to, here's my concern in my previous question, if they turn out to prevail on all those arguments, it could be that the tribe ends up with nothing on the lessee side.
But Ute Energy LLC is the proper party to litigate that issue.
I understand your position, I think.
Well, if the tribe is part of Ute Energy, Ms. Bassett, then what difference does it make if there's sovereign immunity with regard to the tribe as opposed to FIML being able to proceed against Ute Energy?
I'm not sure I understand the question. I'm sorry.
You said that the tribe is part of Ute Energy.
It's a member.
If it's a member of Ute Energy,
yes.
If Ute Energy is liable under any of these various agreements, then FIML can go after Ute Energy, which would include the tribe. Isn't that correct?
No, it's not, because the tribe's interest would be the tribe's interest. I mean, it can go against Ute Energy for assets or whatever the Ute Energy LLC has. But it's sort of like a corporation in that sense. Beyond that, could not get to the tribe's larger assets.
Sure, but to put it another way, if the court declares that Ute Energy has forfeited its rights under the EDA, mm-hmm. then by extension, the tribe has forfeited its share of those rights.
It's our position that this third-party complaint was only filed so that FIMO could get leverage in its, against Ute Energy LLC by sort of holding the tribe hostage in this litigation as the tribe.
Bassett, your client is a signatory to the operating agreement, isn't that correct?
Yes.
All right. And there's been no contention that whoever signed that on behalf of the tribe lacked the authority to do so, is that correct? I don't recall any such contention being raised.
Well, what we do contend and will contend is that any waiver of sovereign immunity in the execution of the operating agreement was unconstitutional under the tribe's constitution.
All right, but that is unconstitutional
in the sense that only the governing body of the tribe, which is its business committee, can waive the tribe's sovereign immunity through either the adoption of an ordinance or a resolution. That did not occur in this case.
Well, let's get to that, because isn't that claim foreclosed by an earlier decision of this court several years ago in Ute Tribe case? I think it was a 2004 decision. That if the person signing it has the authority to do so on behalf of the tribe, that's enough.
I see.
To waive sovereign immunity.
And I'm not sure that we would agree with that position.
All right. But as I understand your position on the operating agreement, it is that, at least in part, that there's this condition precedent, that mm-hmm. is this resolution that you're talking about. But that isn't something that FIML has any ability at all to get. That's within your client's ability to grant, but it's not within FIML's ability to grant. I mean, it can't do anything to get that, but your client signs an agreement saying we will do this, and then it doesn't do it, and then says, oh, because we didn't do it, this isn't enforceable.
I don't agree with that. I mean, it's simply all that FIML had to do in the proceeding below was to come in with the resolution. And then we could have raised our arguments against the applicability of the resolution.
All right. That begs the question whether resolution is required, but let's assume that it was required. Mm-hmm. If it was required, though, that is a condition that is within the control of your client to resolve. And the law is clear that if there's a condition precedent that is within the power of one party to perform, that party can't rely on the non-performance of that condition. You can't say, I agree to do this, but I didn't do it, so it's not enforceable.
But that's a matter of contract law, not court jurisdiction, and the condition precedent goes to the ability of the court to exercise its jurisdiction. So it's not a matter of contract law. It's a matter of the court's jurisdiction. It's a prerequisite to the court proceeding to recognize the waiver.
Well, but here, let's get to the question of whether it is a condition, because the language of it is not written as if it is a condition. And it says, it uses the word, shall be further evidence. And further, I would note, is a word that your brief omitted mm-hmm. from the quote of this provision. That word seems to me to make a lot of difference. So would you explain to me why it doesn't make a difference?
Because I think because of the word shall be further evidence. It's not optional that it be presented. It's mandatory that there be that the resolution be presented. At that point in time, this is before the court says, yes, there's a valid waiver of sovereign immunity. At that point in time, the tribe, as the potential litigant, in a 12B1 motion, can litigate the validity of the waiver. And that's what, I mean, we would have done that had we been representing the tribe at that point. We believe it's a question of jurisdiction, not contract, law, that sort of thing. But if I could, because I see I only have 37.
Why isn't it a question of contract law? I mean, this is a contract. We have to determine under the contract whether sovereign immunity has been waived. Why don't we apply contract law principles to that?
Because it's also a question of jurisdiction, and it's...
The parties can, you can waive jurisdiction by contract.
Yes, but I think the courts have recognized that when jurisdiction is contested under 12B1 motion, that it sometimes turns on factual issues. That factual determination was never made in the court below, and it was the obligation of the appellees to raise that issue, to establish that there was a valid waiver.
Well, it was not their obligation to raise this defense of condition precedent. You're saying they have to raise every conceivable defense to sovereign immunity that might exist out there, whether your client raises it or not? And then knock them down one by one?
It's in the contract itself, so it's not in the same category as every potential defense. And I don't view it as a defense. I view it as a condition precedent. I see I'm out of time.
Thank you for your argument.
I would just like to say that if the court gets beyond the issue of condition precedent, we still don't believe that federal law has been correctly applied insofar as the application of the waiver itself. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Tony Shaheen and Chris Christman on behalf of FIML Natural Resources. With all due respect to the tribe, Judge Hyatt got it absolutely right. FNR has a right under this agreement, the operating agreement, to be in Denver District Court with the tribe. Ms. Bassett talked about the law. The Supreme Court and CNL Enterprises said the waiver has to be clear, has to be definite, has to be unambiguous. The waiver in this case, in the operating agreement, is clear, it is certain, it is definite, it is unambiguous, and most importantly, it is very broad. The tribe waived its sovereign immunity in the operating agreement for a legal proceeding relating, one, to the enforcement of the operating agreement, two, to the interpretation of the operating agreement, or three, to a breach, and for other reasons as well. Everyone in this case agrees that Denver District Court is a legal proceeding. It meets the test.
How do your claims, I'm looking at your claims individually.
Yes, sir.
And let's take, for example, the last two. These are tort claims,
yes, sir,
which claim fraudulent inducement to enter into agreements other than the operating agreement. So how do those relate to the breach, interpretation, or enforcement of the operating agreement?
They also relate because the tribe waived its sovereign immunity for course of dealing between the tribe and FNR.
I think it actually said they don't waive their immunity for course of dealing.
The only time they don't waive their immunity for course of dealing, and it's spelled out in the agreement, is if arguably the course of dealing led to an extension or modification of the terms of the operating agreement. We are not contending that a course of dealing led to any extension or modification of the operating agreement. The last two claims for negligent misrepresentation and fraud are based on the conduct of the tribe in negligently or fraudulently representing to FNR that it was going to pay back the what we call the UEC or UPR, the unrecouped excess capital, which I stumble on all the time, the money it owed us, to the tune of $33 million. So they waived for course of conduct or course of dealing, as long as that course of dealing doesn't extend or modify the terms of the agreement. And that makes sense because Article 17 or Section 17 of the agreement says the operating agreement can only be amended in writing with the consent of all the parties. So we get there by that. We also, Your Honor, get there because by representing they were going to pay us the money, that relates, and the claim only has to relate to, and the agreement says they waive their sovereign immunity for claims relating to the enforcement for payment of the monies due. Under the agreement, the tribe owes you, FNR, I'm sorry, F&R, $33 million. They led F&R, we allege, to believe that they would be paid if F&R, A, signed the letter agreement of February 2005, and more importantly, signed the consent and acknowledgement of April 2005, by which the tribe tried to transfer its interest.
So you're essentially saying that at bottom, your claim rests on the operating agreement and your right to certain monies under the operating agreement, and that those tort claims essentially would be necessary to essentially operate as preemptively to deal away with defenses or the tribe's attempt to argue that it no longer has responsibilities under the operating agreement.
I think that's right, Ryan. It's also broader than that. For example, the first claim, the Declaratory Judgment Act claim, asked the court to decide whether or not the letter, the consent and acknowledgement, the April 2005 letter agreement, whether or not that was effective to transfer the interest of the tribe over to Ute Energy. We're talking about the EDA, and the reason I'd like to avoid it is because there's not much of a factual record down below, but it's very complicated because the letter agreement of February, followed by the consent and acknowledgement, triggers who is a participant under the EDA. But we don't need to get into that because the claims that we assert arise directly and relate directly to the operating agreement.
Counsel, would you just address on that last point how your claim for forfeiture relates to the operating agreement?
Well, it relates in this sense, Your Honor. What I said a moment ago that in February of 2005, the tribe and F&R entered into the letter agreement. And there were a lot of terms and provisions of it. One of the terms and provisions was that the tribe would become a participant under the EDA. That was followed up by the consent and acknowledgement that we found out the tribe and Ute Energy never signed. But if in point of fact we are correct that the tribe became a participant in the EDA as a result of the letter agreement, then the forfeiture provision in the EDA is triggered because the forfeiture provision says if a participant, capital P, does not participate in the drilling of the well, it forfeits its future interest in those leases. Now, it keeps its past acquired interest, but it loses its rights going forward, and that's why it implicates the EDA.
All right, so you are asking for relief under the EDA. You're not just seeking, say, rescission of the EDA.
No, we're not, Your Honor.
All right, so you're asking for affirmative relief under the EDA?
Yes.
Okay. So how does a claim seeking relief under that document specifically fall within the sovereign immunity waiver of an earlier document?
It's actually a later document.
Well, the operating agreement, excuse me.
Okay, that's because the letter agreement implicates the operating agreement because it's an attempt to assign the tribe's interest in Ute F&R to Ute Energy. And that began the letter agreement in February is followed by the consent and acknowledgement. And in the consent and acknowledgement, the tribe requested F&R's consent to be allowed to assign its interest in Ute F&R over to Ute Energy. That triggers Section 15 of the operating agreement, because Section 15 for an assignment requires a writing. And the writing, at least the tribe would argue, is the consent and acknowledgement. F&R's position is, one, they never signed it, and two, they fraudulently induced us to sign it because they promised us they were going to pay us back the money they owed.
Yes, Mr. Shaheen, how come the letter agreement and the consent and acknowledgement don't include any waiver language?
I don't think they need to. Under the agreement, the operating agreement is broad enough. All these documents have to do is relate to the things that the tribe, for which the tribe waived its sovereign immunity. And, you know, we can't lose sight of the fact that this is a very broad, multifaceted business relationship. Ute F&R was created, the tribe and F&R came together to drill wells, to produce oil and gas, to sell oil and gas, and then to sell real property and personal property. It's very multifaceted. The waiver is consistent with that broad scope because it too is broad. And so instead of saying, it would almost be unworkable, Judge, if every document between the parties had to have an express waiver. F&R, as the operator, sends out joint interest billings all the time to the tribe.
Well, the reason for my question, Mr. Shaheen, is because the case law says that the language of a waiver with regard to tribal sovereign immunity must be clear and unmistakable. And so given that, I would have thought that the parties would have included waiver language in those two other documents.
Well, Your Honor, they included waiver language that's broad enough within the operating agreement where it says that the legal proceeding has to relate to the interpretation of the operating agreement, breach of the operating agreement, documents contemplated under the operating agreement, course of dealing. They really left out nothing in that broad waiver. And just because it's broad doesn't make it ambiguous.
What is your view about whether the EDA is an instrument contemplated herein within the meaning of the operating agreement waiver provision?
The operating agreement is an operative document underneath the EDA. And when we look at the operating agreement, there are all kinds of references, numerous references that we went through in our brief, referring to the EDA. So clearly it's contemplated because the parties acted under the EDA. And indeed, the forfeiture provision, the effect of going non-consent and not contributing to the well implicates the EDA. So I think it is a document contemplated. So a document that's heavily referenced in the operating agreement. I would just like to make the point, Your Honor, on the condition preceding argument that we heard. There's been no mention in here about the fact that in section 2.2 of the operating agreement, the tribe represented that this agreement had been approved by all and gotten all necessary approvals, including under the tribal constitution. But if they're correct now, when they come in here and say, we never approved this, then we've got a claim, FNR has got a claim for breach of representation in the operating agreement. And that certainly triggers the waiver of sovereign immunity. And the tribe says, well, you know, this isn't the proper form to litigate this issue. Significantly, the tribe doesn't say what is the proper form. And that sort of harkens, reminds me of what the Supreme Court and Justice Ginsburg wrote in the CNL Enterprise case, where the tribe, in that case, the Potawatomi tribe, was asked, well, where can you litigate? And the answer was no court. And Justice Ginsburg interlineated on the earth or even on the moon. And that's what we're going on here. They gave a representation which they're now saying isn't true, and they're saying you can't come to court and litigate over this document or this agreement.
Mr. Shaheen, if they gave a representation as you suggested, then what was the purpose of the language that the tribe describes as the condition precedent language?
I think it's just like Judge Jones said, Judge Taubman, and that is a sort of belt and suspenders. It's further evidence. And the initial evidence is in 14.3, where the tribe waives its sovereign immunity, and then even goes a step further and surrenders, it says, its sovereign power to get the full determinations of issues of law and fact in a legal proceeding. And then in 2.2, the tribe represents that this agreement has been approved by all necessary ordinance, laws, etc. And then further evidence of this is just simply the resolutions themselves. And it's significant. In their brief, and we point this out in our answer brief, they never say there was never a resolution. They just say that Judge Hyatt ignored the condition precedent. If anybody ignored the condition precedent below, it was the tribe. They didn't raise this issue until they came up here on appeal. And now it's kind of done amorphic. It's not just that it wasn't presented. It is now said that the chairman of the tribe didn't have the authority to enter into it. But that is all correct. That is proof positive that we should be in Denver District Court arguing about this and litigating it, because clearly it goes to breach of the operating agreement. They represented it, that they had approved this. I would just close by saying, Your Honor, I understand the waiver is broad, and that's consistent with the broad business purposes that brought the tribe and FNR together. But it's very, very clear. There's no ambiguity. The tribe waived its sovereign immunity for a legal proceeding. They define that to mean court action, arbitration, and administrative proceeding. And all it has to do is relate to one of those elements: breach, interpretation, enforcement, a document contemplated, course of dealing. And this clearly does. The issues in this case clearly do. And under C&L and other cases, if the waiver is clear, it's precise, it's unambiguous, it must be enforced. If you have no further questions, I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes the arguments of this case. Court thanks both counsel for their arguments. This case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.